Well, good morning, everyone. Good morning. My name is Brendan. I am one of the pastors here on staff. Thrilled to be here with you this morning, and I'm just going to jump right into it. This morning, we are talking about relationships. That should elicit a chuckle from you. I'm a youth pastor saying we're talking about relationships, and you ask me, what experience do I have? Not much. I am ringless on my fingers. And I'm just going to give it away. The formula to any healthy relationship this morning. It's up on the screen here. Relationships are defined by their posture and their perspective. Posture and perspective. So we could say a good relationship is defined by right posture, right? You know, when instead of coming into friendship with your arms crossed, looking at the other person, expecting something from them, and in your mind, you're prideful, you're full of yourself, right? This posture is both both a physical thing, you know, arms crossed, and it's also like an attitude. Whether you're willing to enter into vulnerability or not, you know, these things make up our posture, and also our perspective. A good relationship is defined by a right perspective. Knowing that there's two people in the relationship, right? That the world doesn't revolve around either person. It's the right perspective. And this morning, we're talking about this. And I was trying to think of a story from my own life, but I couldn't. And so I thought back to, my grades 8 years, and if you're in grade 8, I'm sorry, because it is the most awkward years of our lives. There's lots of things, and maybe it's just guys, but you know, there's awkwardness already about the age and middle school and so much stuff happening, and then you throw on hormones in the mix, and then you like increase the awkwardness tenfold. And one day, my own story there, I had a girlfriend for 2 weeks in grade 8. We didn't speak to one another. We passed notes as we passed each other in the hallway. It was really good. But my friend Russell, he really liked this girl, Kristen. Liked her a lot. And Russell's kind of awkward, like we're all awkward. And so he had a hard time going and talking to Kristen. And so me and a couple of buds were like, Russell, we know she'll say yes because we got it on the inside loop from my friend whose friend is friend with Kristen. And she's totally into you, man. And so we're like, Russell, go ask her. And he's like, no, I don't want to. And we're like, we'll give you $2 if she says yes. And Russell's like, yeah, totally, I'll do it. And so he like struts over there, hot stuff. And we're in the hallway, and me and my friends are just hanging out. And Russell goes over, and we can't hear what they're saying. But it looks like it's going well, right? You know, at first, Kristen is like up against the wall, like arms crossed. And then Russell comes up and starts chatting. And you know, the frown or just whatever it was, she starts to smile, and she starts to nod. And me and Daniel, my friend, we're like, yeah, Russell, you got it. And then as soon as like she's like nodding and like I think she's saying yes, Russell turns around. It's like, yo guys, you owe me $2. It's the wrong perspective. It's the wrong posture to enter into a relationship. You know, we get this. You know, maybe you go in for a hug, and the person puts out their hand for a handshake instead. It sucks, but posture says a lot about relationships. And we're going to read a parable. And maybe you're going to be wondering why I'm speaking about relationships, but let me read this parable that Jesus told, and then we'll get back to that. It's Luke 18, 9 to 14. If you don't have a Bible, feel free to grab one in front of you. It's on page 732, in the Bible in front of you. Luke 18, 9 to 14. Jesus speaking. To some who were confident of their own righteousness and looked down on everyone else, Jesus told this parable, little story. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood by himself and prayed, God, I thank you that I'm not like the other people, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even this tax collector. I fast twice a week and give a tenth of all I got. But the tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven, but beat his breast and said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. I tell you that this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. So why am I speaking about relationships? You know, on the surface, what we see are two men going up to pray. So isn't this a parable about prayer? Check out the first verse, verse 9 with me. To some who were confident of their own righteousness and looked down on everyone else, Jesus told this parable. We have somebody, Luke, setting up why Jesus told this parable. Sometimes Jesus' parables are hard to understand, and so Luke does a little work for us and says, this is why Jesus is telling this parable, because there are those who trusted in themselves, those who were confident of their own righteousness. Righteousness. This is kind of the key word. And when we see prayer throughout the rest of the parable, I kind of like to picture it as like a burrito, and prayer is the wrap that holds the meat of the burrito inside. And so the vehicle of the story is prayer, and the meat of the story, what's inside, is righteousness. So we have to ask ourselves, what is righteousness? And two things. There would have been the Greek kind of or Hellenistic hearers, like if they're reading this, and we would be similar to them, who when they think of righteousness, they think of keeping legal codes, of being morally and ethically proper, essentially. And so we would say the same thing. Somebody who is righteous is somebody who's just a good person, good guy, good girl. Like they keep the law, they're doing well, they're righteous. What the Hebrews would have heard, what the Israelites would have heard, and these are the people that Jesus is speaking to, is righteousness actually not in terms of this transactional, I'll do this, therefore I'm righteousness, but rather in terms of a relationship. Kenneth Bailey actually says it best. He says, the righteous person is not the one who observes a particular code of ethics, but rather a person or community granted a special relationship of acceptance in the presence of God. Righteousness is about a relationship. And specifically, what this parable is talking about is not any relationship. It's specifically a relationship between the community or the person and God. And so righteousness is a right relationship with God. Two things. Maybe you're here today And God is still a question that's over there that hasn't maybe been addressed in your life, or maybe you just asked the question and have ignored it, or maybe just don't believe in God. Let me just pose a thought experiment. If God is real, and more specifically, if the God of the Bible is real, somebody who is all-powerful, who is all-knowing, who has created the world and actually created us and knows you better than you know yourself, and therefore he knows what's best for you and actually knows what will bring you most joy and life and happiness. If this God is real, then a question begs to be asked. Why would we not want to enter into a right relationship with that God? So if God is real, would we want to enter into a right relationship with him? And then for those of us who've maybe been walking in that relationship for a while, I think this parable is especially poignant. Notice who Luke sets this parable up towards. Those who trusted in themselves, or those who were confident in their own righteousness. I bet, I'm just going to go out on a limb here. I bet that most of the time when we read parables in the New Testament, a thought comes to mind, especially when it's parables about the Pharisee. A thought is, oh, thank goodness I'm not like those Pharisees. If you were reading as we did the parable, if we do that, we're actually exactly like the Pharisees. The Pharisee compares himself to others and like, thank goodness I'm not like them. And so, if you're like me and who has thought once or twice or more than twice that, thank goodness I'm not like the Pharisees, this parable is for us too. So, Jesus tells a parable on how we can enter into a right relationship with God. And it all has to do with posture and perspective. All has to do with posture and perspective. Let's dig right into it. Verse 10, two men went up to the temple to pray. One a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. All of Jesus' parables seem like the start of a joke or something. But they went up to the temple to pray, and Jesus just automatically sets up two people against themselves. One, a Pharisee, you know, somebody who's righteous in the transactional sense, who's keeping commands, laws, everything. He is a good person, well-respected in the community. Everyone wants to be a Pharisee. And then on the other hand, you have a tax collector, despicable, despised, has pretty much sold out his fellow brothers and sisters of the Israelite nation as it's worked with the oppressor, oppressive Roman government, and who makes a lot of money, not righteous by those legal standards, and he's here, despised, despicable. So you have tax collector, Pharisee, and starts with the Pharisee, verse 11. Before I do that, they're going to, and this is key, they're going to a temple to pray. When we say prayer, I bet what comes to mind is a private me and God. It's a private thing. What happens in this kind of context culture, you know, going to the temple to pray is both private, but it's a public event. Maybe you have a Muslim friend, and when they say, I'm going to the mosque to pray, they're going to the mosque to pray, but there's community there. It is not just a private event. And so in Eastern culture like this, going to the temple to pray is not just a private event. It's also a public event. And that's going to be very key in just a moment. So verse 11 starts with the Pharisee. The Pharisee stood by himself and prayed. Pause. This is where Jesus turns and points to the Pharisee's posture. What is he doing? There's a group of people here, right? There's a group of people at the temple. The Pharisee stands separate from the group. And I think he's standing separate from the group, not because he's like, he doesn't want to be noticed, but I think it's the opposite. I think, one, he thinks he's too good to be associated with the group of people, which we'll find out soon. And secondly, he's actually been following all these commands that the Pharisees had to follow in order to become clean. And if he were to associate or even brush up against somebody like the tax collector, he is automatically unclean in his worldview. He's unclean. And so he's standing off to the side. And there's something else that Jesus talks about when he mentions prayer in Matthew. And Jesus says, don't be like the hypocrites who stand on street corners or in the Pharisee or in the temple with loud voices, right, expecting to be heard. Don't be like those guys off to the side, waving their arms and saying, oh, look at me, how holy am I? The posture of the Pharisee is here, and it's like, oh, but like this, he's looking at the others, he's sneering on the others, and it's kind of condescending. And I think that as the Pharisee moves over there, I can't help but to think of my own posture. You know, maybe it's late at night and I'm halfway through a binge marathon of Office or something, and some guy calls me and I'm like, oh, I should listen. I should like take that phone call, but it's like, oh, thank goodness for call display. Slide it back into my pocket. You know, I'm not the only one who's done that, right? No. Okay. Good. Maybe it's a conversation where we go into meeting somebody new. This has happened to me before. Meeting somebody new, and they have to prove to us why I should like them, right? Like me meeting Joel for the first time, it's like, what's this guy got? Why should I care about him? And so we kind of stand off like this. It's like, impress me. Maybe we come into a worship gathering like this, a community, and we expect Becca and the worship team and Keith and the other pastors to bring us somewhere, Okay, what do you got for me this week? And oftentimes when we enter into worship, our posture is so reflective of our heart. Our physical posture is so reflective of our heart. I did YWAM after high school, And one of these times, we're doing worship. And I'm a Mennonite boy from small town McGregor, Manitoba, right? Small town. So us, when we get into worship, it's like this. This is head nodding, eyes closed. This is me, Mennonite kids, worshiping really good because we're not allowed to dance. That's sinful. And so I was literally like this, and I'm like hands. And actually, this is a big step for me. I'm singing songs, and a big step. I'm like looking around, make sure everyone's engaged. I'm like, oh yeah, I'm doing good. And then something happens. This guy, I'm like doing this, and then I just feel my hands just get lifted up like this. And I turn around, and I'm like, yo, dude, like, what's your problem? And I saw it was the teacher, Mark, for the week. I'm like, yo, Mark, what is your deal? And he just goes off and does this thing, Mark. And anyways, I'm going to raise my hands, and I just make sure he's gone, and then I let my hands go down. And then keep on singing the songs, and I'm still into it. Like, this is really good. This is good worship. Like, no joke, a song later, he comes up to me again. My hands are like this. He comes up to me and raises my hands again. And I'm, like, a little bit ticked off. I'm not even worshiping God at this point. I'm like, yo, Mark, what is your deal? And he's like, Brendan, you got to worship God. And I'm like, that's so vague. And so, like, I do this for a little bit longer. And then I go up to him after the worship set is done. I'm like, Mark, honestly, why do you keep on lifting my hands up? And he's like, Brendan, If your posture can't worship God while you're like worshiping God, and I could tell you're worshiping God, then what are you gonna do when you don't feel like worshiping God? And I was like, oh man. And then he's like, Brendan, get this. This is something that's helping. Every time I don't feel like worshiping God, and I can feel just my heart closing down towards him, I can feel my arms starting to go like this. I actually put my hands up. And I'm like, even when you don't feel like it, aren't you being fake? And then he just told me something crazy happens. And he's like, when you put your hands up, it's weird. When we enter with our body, sometimes the rest of us just follows. Have you ever prayed for someone that you don't like? Do you notice your heart changing towards that person? Yeah. Have you ever given somebody a hug who you're frustrated with? Oh, that melts away. It is weird how our posture brings us someplace. Anyways, I got super convicted that day. Most of the time when you see me raising my hands in worship, it's not because I actually want to worship God anymore. So don't look at me, though. I sit in the front. So posture's key. And then it goes on to the next piece. God, I thank you that I am not like the other people, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. Thank you, I am not like these other people. Posture is so critical. Perspective. Perspective is who is at the center of the story, right? Who is center of your world? Who's the lead in the play? This is perspective. And in the Pharisee's mind, he himself was the lead, right? He was the person that everybody else revolved around. And so he could look out at others and be like, hey, I'm better than they are. Hey, I'm better than they are. I always wondered, what would the Pharisee do if, like, the high priest Pharisee, extra super holy guy came in and the Pharisee would have looked at him? I wonder what he would have thought. Would he have been jealous? Would it be like, oh man, that guy, I know he fasts like four times a week, like not even twice. I don't know if that's humanly possible, but he fasts a lot. And I wonder what. Maybe he would have remembered. It's like, oh yeah, I remember like 2 years ago at the Christmas party. They wouldn't have had a Christmas party. But 2 years ago at the Christmas party when the guy had one too many drinks or something, maybe he would have tried to cut the guy down a size. If we are at the center of our story, we will find ourselves comparing ourselves to others, and this is so damaging. Because regardless of the type of relationship that you have, if you are the center of that relationship, and you start to compare yourselves with others, it is gonna be toxic. Because there's two things happen. One is you either think somebody is worse than you, and so you So you tear them down, even with your mind or with your words. And secondly, instead of celebrating somebody's victories, you become jealous of their victories. Right? Instead of when my brother does something incredibly awesome, for a while I struggled with jealousy. Like, man, I wish I was like my brother. He's so cool. He does all these cool things. He travels all over the world. He makes all these sweet videos. Like, I wish I was like my brother. And there was a time there that instead of celebrating my brother's accomplishments and successes, I actually was jealous. Perspective is key, and the Pharisee has a perspective where God is not even in the realm of visibility. He's not even in the realm. And it leads us to the next part. And this next verse, it might just seem like an addition, but I'm going to argue that it's the most important verse in this entire parable. It's the most important line in the entire parable. You know, I fast twice a week, and I give a tenth of all I get. Typical Pharisee fasting was once a month, so he's above and beyond that. Typical giving, tithing, was actually only 10% of the food that you had. It wasn't 10% of everything. So the Pharisee is above and beyond fasting, above and beyond tithing. The reason why this is so important is because in this moment, by saying that he's done all these things, he is saying that he has made a way to be in a right relationship with God all by himself. The Pharisee, by boasting and bragging, first by comparison, first by his posture, and then by saying he has made a way, right? I fast and I tithe. God, can you not but help but be in a relationship with me? That is what is implicit in this line. And I think this is where the readers would have clued in on something. The listeners would have clued in on something. They would be like, oh yeah, where was the Pharisee? Where was the tax collector? They went up to the temple to pray. What is happening at the temple? And this is where things get real. Because at the temple, there is an atonement sacrifice. It's like this worship experience where the readers actually and the people participating would participate and remember what God had done for them. What God had done for them. And so this is what is going on. The tax collector and the Pharisee would have been in this gathering of people who were looking and participating in an atonement sacrifice. And we'll talk about atonement in just a second. Atonement, if you just Google it in dictionary, it's a reparation or satisfaction for something that was made wrong or an injury. I don't know if it would be a stretch to say, like, when you get a settlement when somebody hits you in a car crash, that's like atoning for what went wrong. How I define atonement is this. So skip ahead a couple times, Cam. Right here. So atonement is God's saving work that brings people into a right standing with him so that they can enjoy a right relationship with him. And we're just going to pause on the parable, and we're going to just spend a couple minutes talking about atonement, but it is key to what's going on here. So there's three things, right? The first thing, it's God's saving work. Who is the one acting in atonement? Who's the one acting? It's God. He is the one saving. That's key. And it leads us to the second thing. Saving so that people, so it brings people into a right standing. Those first two things beg the question, why are we in need of saving? And why do we need to be brought back into right standing? That means we must be within wrong standing with God, right? I had a student ask me once, why does God seem, this is a big question, I'm not going to answer it all. Why does God seem like a tyrant in the Old Testament and lovey-dovey in the New Testament? That's a big question, and fair, actually. And I thought about it. It always catches me for a loop when somebody asks a question like that. And then I asked him, it's like, hey, do you think you can love without desiring justice? Do you think you can love somebody without also wanting justice? And he didn't know where I was going with that. And so I asked him, it's like, so say you see somebody being hurt, see someone being harassed or abused. Two things happen in that time. One, our heart Our heart goes out to the person who is in pain. Our heart goes out to the person who's being hurt. Right? We love that person. And then there's also something that flares up in us. Right? It's the desire for justice. It's the desire for the person who is doing the harming to get what they deserve. And that desire for justice is in all of us. And we see it. If we turn on the news, especially in the past month or whatever months, like scandal after scandal, and these things that were in the dark are being brought to light. Like your heart goes out to the people who are being hurt, but then you also want justice. You want justice for the people who are doing the hurting. You want them to pay for what they've done wrong. And that brokenness in our world, we can feel it. We can feel the brokenness in our world. And I think, like, a silly example, if you were to go to your car after this and somebody had smashed into it and had just peaced out, you would expect someone to leave a note, right? If somebody didn't leave a note, that would be incredibly frustrating. But you would expect them to leave a note. You know, even in those small things, we require justice. And God does something incredible. He looks at us, and he loves us so much. He loves you so much. And he sees all of you. He sees the good, the bad, and the ugly. And those parts that when we're really honest with ourselves, he sees that. And he's like, man, I love you so much. And there's things in your life that actually require justice for so that you can come back into a right standing and enjoy freedom. And when we're honest with ourselves, we can see areas that we're not always like perfect either. There's something silly that I do with my youth. I say, imagine if you had a USB matrix thing on the back of your head and you downloaded all your thoughts for an entire day onto a USB stick. And then we plugged it into the projector and it had a running commentary of all your thoughts and everything. And then we played a commentary on the screen before the service. And as everyone was walking in, they saw what you thought of everything throughout the whole day. Like, is that a good feeling? Good, okay. There's things that even when during our normal day, even just quick thoughts like, oh yeah, man, I'm better than that person. I deserve differently. And so there's a brokenness inside each one of us. And in that brokenness, God sees it, and we're out of standing with him. So atonement is God making a way so that we can be in right standing and to enjoy the fruit of that right standing. And that is a right relationship with God, the one who knows the way to life. Knows the way to freedom. And that's why there's justice. That God requires the justice for it to right those wrongs so that he can bring us into freedom. And the Pharisee, he misses this. He misses this completely. This is the sad part. He misses the fact that he needs God to save him, because even as he's comparing himself to all others, he's showing himself how broken. Showing us how broken he really is. He's so caught up in himself. He's prideful. And then Jesus turns to the tax collector. You know, but the tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven, but he beat his breast and said, he stood at a distance. At first glance, it looks similar to the Pharisee, doesn't it? Right, the crowd is there. The Pharisee is standing at a distance, and the tax collector is standing at a distance. But there's something different about how he's standing at a distance. It's not because he thinks he's better than everybody else. It's actually because he thinks he's not worthy enough to enter in. He thinks that everyone in there is so good, and like he is such an awful person. He's not going to enter in, and so he's standing off to the side, head hung low, and he does something that only happens one other time. In the New Testament, he starts beating his chest. The only other time this happens, this extreme form of agony and pain, is when Jesus actually dies at the cross. And those around start beating their chest and wailing and crying out. The tax collector posture is one of complete humility. I have nothing to offer. I have nothing. And it leads into his prayer, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. God, have mercy on me, a sinner. This is interesting that he identifies himself as a sinner. I've always thought what it would be like, hey, my name is Brendan, good to meet you, I'm a sinner. That's a strange comment to make. But in doing so, it's this shift where the Pharisee, you know, was at the center of his world. The tax collector's perspective is he's actually not at the center. He's off to the side, and he has rightfully put God where God should be, God at the center. And something happens. When God is at the center of our lives, we don't start comparing ourselves to those around us. We actually start comparing ourselves to God. And that's actually a scary thought to make, because God, perfect, holy, just, loving, and we see ourselves imperfect, not just, not loving as we should love, and we start to realize that, oh boy, I have fallen far away. I have fallen far away. I am not all that I think I want to be. And at first, this is actually assaulting, I think. It's like, yeah, Brendan, you're saying that like we're not good people inherently. And at first, that's assaulting. But I choose to see it as freeing. And this is why. The world itself, our entire culture, has built itself on saying, you do you. That's like what millennials might be forcing these days. But they're also saying that the fix for your problems is within yourself. The fix for your happiness, your joy, your peace, your life is within yourself. Or maybe it's what yourself can do, and so you can put up a nice house, a nice family, a nice boat, a nice job, all these things around so you can shield yourself. This is what the culture, we have a $10 billion self-help industry that says the help that you need is within yourself, which confuses me because I feel like that $10 billion, if it was actually helping, would not be $10 billion because people would get helped and then it wouldn't be $10 billion anymore. But it is an incredibly freeing moment when we realize, oh, I'm not okay. And then as we should say here, it's okay to not be okay. It's okay to not be okay. It's okay to not have the answers to everything. It's okay to be honest with ourselves and realize that we fall short, and to be honest with ourselves and realize that we can't love as we should, and that we can't give as we should, and we can't be the people that we need to always be. It's okay. And this is what the tax collector gets. His perspective is bang on. He gets it. He gets that he is not okay. He gets that he's not okay, and he makes this prayer, simple prayer, God, have mercy on me. God, have mercy on me. Or you could read, God, save me. God, make an atonement for me. He's there participating in what everyone else is participating in the temple, and he sees it, and he's like, he longs for it. God, save me, bring me back into a right standing with you so that I can enjoy a right relationship with you. And what does Jesus say happens? You know, I tell you, this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. He goes away justified. He goes away in right standing with God. That's what that word means. He goes away in right standing with God and apparently enjoying a right relationship with God. What? The tax collector, the despised, the lowly, the one who is so far off, who has not kept the commands, that is unfair. Why should the tax collector go free when I'm sitting over here, I'm reading the Bible, I'm praying, I'm giving tithes? Why should he go free and I have to do all this work? It's this parable is pointing ahead to something incredible. It's a longing of justice and of love that is only found in the person of Jesus Christ. Worship team, you can kind of come up, and as the worship team comes up, I just want to share a little bit of this story, and I'm not going to do it, but I'm going to turn to a guy who wrote Hebrews, and this is what he says. The law which is what the Pharisee and the tax collector and all those people in the temple were participating in, you know, that you have to achieve a certain measure of standard, is only a shadow of the good things that are coming. It's a shadow. What the tax collector experienced, that mercy that he experienced, is a shadow of the good things that are coming, not the realities themselves. Day after day, every priest stands and performs his religious duties. Again and again, he offers the same sacrifices, which can never take away sins. But when the priest, when Jesus has offered for all time one sacrifice for sins, he sat down at the right hand of God. For by one sacrifice, he has made perfect forever those who are being made holy. Jesus was the one who sacrificed himself. Jesus was the one who looked down on us and saw and loved us. And this is the crazy thing. He loved the Pharisee. He loved the tax collector. He sees the brokenness in each one of us. He sees that we're not okay. And God, out of his incredible love, sends the son Jesus to save us. It's like, how does Jesus save us? Because Jesus is a unique person who was the only one to ever be in right standing with God always. The only one to ever be in right standing with God. And so Jesus does something incredible because he loves us so much and he sees the brokenness that we all carry inside of us. He sees the brokenness of our world and he says, I gotta fix that brokenness. But that brokenness requires justice to fix. And so Jesus does something that we can't do. He provides justice by offering himself. As the radical story of Christianity is that we can't do it. We are broken, but Jesus can. Jesus is not broken. And he does something on our behalf. He actually breaks himself so that we could be made whole. The posture of Jesus is one who, though he is in the image of God, came down, died on our behalf, broke himself because he saw. He saw the need that we have, the justice that we need. And so something radical happens. And this is the freeing part. The radicalness is that no matter how good our posture is, right? No matter how humble you are, no matter how much you cry, no matter how much you beat your chest, you cannot get God. No matter how good your perspective is, right? Even if God is in the center of your perspective, even if you know that you're broken, even if you know that you can't achieve what you want to achieve, even if you know that you can't love the way you want to love, that actually doesn't get you God. The only thing that brings you back into a right relationship with God is Jesus himself. Jesus. And so our right relationship with God is not actually based on our own posture or perspective. It's actually based on Christ's. It's based on him. And there's a verse that's going to come up on screen here. I think a lot of us will have the first few verses memorized. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Right, this is the picture of God being in the center, us being over here, recognizing that we are not God, that we cannot be like God. We cannot create joy and lasting peace in our own lives. We cannot bring reconciliation and healing to this broken world. God can. And all are justified freely by his grace through the redemption that came by Jesus Christ. Justified. We are all brought back into right standing with Christ. God presented Christ as a sacrifice of atonement through the shedding of his blood to be received by faith. God presented Christ as his saving work to bring us back into his right standing so that we can enjoy a right relationship with God through the shedding of Jesus' blood. That's cool. That's great. And there's something incredible. We don't have to do very much. I said very little at all. And when we're entering a time of communion, and it is neat how this parable landed on a communion Sunday. And so communion servers, you can kind of take your places, because Communion itself is a response. It's a response to actually everything that we've talked about this morning. It's a response saying, I can't, God. Can you for me? There's two parts of communion. There's bread and there's wine, and we don't do wine in our church. We do juice. And the bread represents Jesus breaking his body on our behalf, becoming broken so that we could become whole, and his blood being poured out for us so we could enter into a right relationship with God. And Keith normally says something every time he does communion, and it's just so fitting that we come to communion with nothing. Hands open, nothing. But we leave with everything. Because the only thing that we're required to come to God with is this peace. It's faith. And so this last verse here in Romans, it says to be received by faith. To be received by faith. That is the only peace that we're required to come to God with. And it's incredible because as we receive God by faith, suddenly we're welcomed into a freedom of life that only God can have. Only God can provide. We're going to sing a song here as we do communion. And the song is an oldie. It's called Rock of Ages, and there's a line in it that says, Rock of Ages, cleft for me. We don't use the word cleft anymore in English. But what cleft means is Rock of Ages, cleft for me. There is a rock, and that is Jesus. And he is actually broken apart, made a crevice so that we can hide ourselves in him. And so as we participate in communion, as you come forward and remember what Jesus has done, we also receive by faith the invitation. It's an invitation to come back into a right standing with God, to enjoy a right relationship with him. It's the invitation. And so we come with hands, nothing in our hands, but we'll leave with everything. And that's the promise that we have in Jesus Christ. So as Becca and the band plays, the communion tables are set up. There's gluten-free options at each table. And so feel free, as you feel led, if you're responding with a yes to Jesus, that's all we ask for you when you come to the table, responding with a yes to Jesus. So feel free just to come up, grab some of the juice and the bread. You can partake here at the front, or you can go back to your tables or your seats and partake there. Great.